We're back at the races. Back at Lowe's Ventana. And the Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Racing. And the first of the prominent alumni. You would consider yourself a prominent alumni.
I am super prominent. I have honor. I'm a part of the, I was inducted into the Hispanic Hall of Fame here.
How about that?
That's an honor right there. So that was a pretty fun day. I remember that. So you're breathing my air right now, Steve.
That's true. That's true. And of course, so, you know, it's funny because there's, I'm sure by now most people know and remember the connection, Midnight Loot with Lute Olson, and you know, so much of you know, the course of your career. Bob Baffert with us, by the way, if you don't recognize the voice. This is such a terrific place, and of course the program, you were one of the, you know, the first third of the program's alums, and what even brought you here? How did you even know there was an opportunity, and as opposed to just going out, you know, onto a racetrack and starting out the way a lot of people do?
Well, I grew up an hour from here in Nogales on the border, and so all my siblings, we all went to the U of A because this is where you went. You didn't have a choice. We didn't have a choice to go anywhere.
Nobody was going to Tempe?
No, nobody. We didn't like the ASU. It was too far away anyway. So we came here, and so I promised my mother. I wanted to be a jockey. That was my – but I promised my mother that I would graduate from college. And so because, you know, she was a teacher for many years and a principal, so she was really, you know, education was very important. And you know, in those days, you know, you raise your child, you make sure they graduate from college, and then you kick them loose and let them go on their way. And so I came here. This was the only school. And when I came here, I was just going to get a bachelor's degree in something, and this racing program came to life. So I thought, wow, get some pretty easy courses here. Maybe I have a shot of passing, you know. So but it was really interesting, and I met a lot of good friends. You know, I met Jimmy Bell. He has John Bell Farm, and we became really good friends. And no, but it was, you know, my best years were here in college. I mean, I had a blast. I was in a fraternity. I did everything, you know. The whole thing. And so and then my friends started graduating. I thought, I better get serious here. And and then as soon as I graduated, then I just still went. I gravitated back to the horses. My father had a, you know, couple horses we had raised, and so I was messing with them. And then finally I just became a jockey. I wanted to go back to riding, and so I was just too big, and when I went back home, I took about a year off, so I became a substitute teacher in Nogales.
Is that right?
Because if you have a degree, you can get a substitute teacher. So I was making like $40 a day. They'd call me up at 6 in the morning, hey, we need you. I mean, they need a substitute. There was a lot of jobs. There weren't too many people. It's basically babysitting for a day or whatever. And I did first grade, third, high school. I did it all. And then they stuck me in a junior high because this teacher had a nervous breakdown in sixth grade, so I had to take over his history course for like the rest. This we're talking about in November, so I did the whole year. And
how about that?
So I had to really, you know, I had to learn about history really quick. So I taught history, and I decided I do not want to be a teacher. That is not for me. I don't have that kind of patience. And so I said, I want to get back out there. And, I gravitated right back to the horses. And then I got a job. This guy gave me a job on a little training, a little farm in Prescott, Arizona for the summer. And he decided to get a horse. And he said, you know, maybe I'll run a horse. And so I bought it from Los Alamitos. I bought it from Bobby Adair, the jockey. Huh. I called him up. I want to buy a horse. So we bought a horse for $17,000 to run at Prescott Downs for this Pete Sams that lived in Phoenix. And he had a little 5-acre farm with 3 broodmare, 4 yearlings that I broke for him. And so I said, Bobby, I said, I'll buy the horse, but you have to come ride at Prescott Downs. Prescott Downs was a little tiny, very dangerous racetrack. He said he would, and he came in, and he rode the trials, and we ran second in the fraternity. And And then all of a sudden, I thought, man, this is, you know, it's pretty cool. Then we ran him in another race, and there was some trainers that got in trouble. They had some drug positives, some big trainers, and a couple of trainers, and so they had a lot of good horses, and nobody knew where to go. So one of the owners called me up and said, this guy Ray Yeh says, "Hey Bob, I got 20. They had nice horses." He goes, "Would you take these horses?" And I go, "Wow, those are
you're in business."
I'm in business, so I said I took those, and then that's when I started up. It was 1980, and then I won my first stakes win in November of 1980, and it was like snowballed into that, and then I got more owners, and next thing you know, I had started out with about. And I remember when I started out, I didn't really have a lot of cash on me. So I went to my grandmother. I said, "I need to borrow $1,000 from you." And she says, "For what?" She says, "I need to buy buckets." And I had to buy buckets.
Equipment. So sure. Equipment, you have to get tacked.
Stuff for about, you know, 8 horses. I was going to buy 10 horses, whatever it was. And she said, "And I'll pay you back in 45 days. He says, "None of you children have ever paid me back. I swear to you, I'm going to pay you back, and I'm going to give you interest." So sure enough, I paid her back. I'm the only one that ever paid her back.
You're the favorite grandson.
I gave her a little interest. It was my dad's mother. And so she got me going. And she'd always ask me, "Well, how much are you going to make?" "Well, I think I can make." She'd always say, net. I said, you know, that was a word then, you know. And so that's how I got going. And pretty soon I hit the ground running, started winning, and then all of a sudden I got all these good horses. And see, before I only trained for my dad or a few horses, just our homebreds.
Yeah,
he was holding me back, Steve. That's why. And once I got these better horses, then I started winning, and I really got more confidence. And that's what, you know. And next thing you know, I had, you know, 40 horses in my barn. And we were rolling. I mean, we weren't running for very much money.
New Mexico and
no, just Arizona.
Just Arizona.
We
ran just
Relito all winter.
How about that?
On the weekends all winter. And then I would.
What were the pots like?
$300. But the fraternities were like $10,000, $15,000,
$20,000. Sure, because everybody's paying in.
Yeah, so, you know, if you win the fraternity, you make $1,000, you know, $10,000 to the winner. And that's where the excitement. But, you know, in those days, you know, it wasn't, you know, we'd win a race or whatever. But just the excitement, you know, So we'd go here, and then we'd hit the fairs, little fraternities on the fair, Sonoyta, where I grew up,
yeah.
The Sonoyta fraternity, and then we'd go to Prescott, Arizona. And then after Prescott, we'd hit the fairs with Kingman, Arizona. We'd hit that place, and then we'd go to Holbrook, Arizona. So it was sort of fun to go to these
sure.
weekends, and we used to run to Douglas, Arizona. It was a weird track down there. The surface was grindings from the mines, the copper mines. It was weird. Like a weird surface, like almost like not gravel, but just a like a green colored.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like really weird. Like
green, like from verdigris that from the aging. If it was copper, it must have aged. It must have from the elements, it would turn green.
It was something, man. It was the weirdest track I remember. And
Douglas.
I don't think they don't run there anymore. But I'll never forget that surface. Like it was weird. And it wasn't like
that's
soft.
Crazy.
It was just like there were grindings of the something, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember that really well. And then we start back at Relito, and, you know, I broke all the records there and everything. But it was fun. You know, it was a lot
sure.
of fun. And one thing about it, we never complained about the track was too hard or too fast. Or it was just a glob of mud sometimes. And big old dirt clods in it. We never complained about. We never complained about any track that we went to.
Just went. You ran. You
we
won.
Just
you lost.
Up, we ran, and we were happy to be there.
When did the transition start to come, and opportunities to go to LaSalle and hit the bigger quarter horse circuit?
Well, that was, you know, I was getting some horses from Los Alamitos because at the time that's when there was an overabundance of horses at Los Alamitos. And it was hard to get a 3-year-old maiden in at Los Alamitos. They had so many horses
wow.
there. So a lot of those trainers would send their horses to me at Relito to break their maiden so they could get a stall at Los Alamitos.
Ah.
So I was getting all these well-bred Dash for Cashes, all these royally bred horses that really weren't that good. So they'd send them to me, like Blaine Swanevelt would send me some.
Nice.
And these are owned by big-time owners, like the Bass Brothers from Houston and you know, really well-bred horses, and I'd had all Easy Jets, all these. You know, they weren't that great, but I did train for Rulon Goodman. I took over for him, and he ran the track, and he had a lot of good horses.
What, as that is happening, and we'll talk about, you know, moving the thoroughbreds as part of it, but what about training quarters and working with quarters? What did you learn, and what, I mean, or is it a commonality between the breeds, between quarters and thoroughbreds and even standardbreds, I suppose, that is universal? But, you know, what kind of things did you take with you and that you still rely on, that you learned from your, you know, from early horsemanship experiences?
I think a lot of it was, you know, when I first started, I used to break all my own horses, and you learn how to point a horse for a race, because in quarter horses, you want to get them, you have to run in the trials, and there's like, you know, there'll be, you know, 50, 60 horses trying to get, in Arizona, trying to get eight spots, eight horse gate. I think it's eight in Rialto, or I don't know if it was 10, I forget what it was, I think it was eight. And so, because the tracks are so narrow. And so you want to run in the trials. You want them to qualify, run fast enough, but not really just completely just
have something left.
Something left. And so I would train the really good ones, the ones I really knew that could really run. I could just sort of get them through there, and they'd qualify. They'd qualify sixth, seventh, eighth. You know, they could do it on their own accord. But the ones that were like, you know, I'd have them ready for their, so I could, you know, you want to have, because they pay all the way down. You know, you get a
something.
You get a thousand if you run last or whatever. So, but it was fun. There was a Sonoyta Futurity in Arizona near Nogales that my dad and my uncle, the one that got it going, and that was, to me, that was, it was run on the first Saturday of May. That was the, and we could never win it. We tried, you know, I could never win that thing, you know. So finally, when I made my move to Los Alamitos, Brad McKenzie talked me into coming to Los Alamitos. He said, you got to come now. They had a race secretary that was really tough there. His name was Curly Smith. He was tough. Because I remember going there with one horse of my dad's, and I had it there, and he gave me one stall, and I ran it, and I ran it, and it bucked in the race. It came out, it bucked. It didn't buck the jockey, but it bucked. So you had to qualify your horses. So he put me on the list, so I had to qualify it, like in the mornings, work at 350 yards. So I work at 350 yards, and I go check the list. He's still on the list. I have to do it again. So I wanted to bring another horse in. So I remember going into his office, and he says, Mr. Smith, and everybody was terrified of this guy. Those are the years that the race secretaries, they just were scared of him. And so I said, Mr. Smith, I noticed that my horse is still on the list, and he worked today. He says, don't come in here and tell me what I need to do. He says, you know, Mr. Baffert, how many stalls did I give you? I says, one. And where did you come from? I came from Arizona. He says, usually when I give one stall to a guy from out of state, that usually means they're not going to come. But you showed up. You know, that's why I gave you one, because I put in for two, you know. And so, but, well, now that we're on the subject, I do have a second one that I want to bring. And he said, well, he said, and he stomped the, he said, well, you just come in here and say, Mr. Smith, I need another stall. And he stomped the table. So then for some reason, I stomped the table and says, Mr. Smith, I need another stall. And he says, all right, go ahead and bring it in. I'll find a deal. So, and I brought another horse, and they were my dad's, and they never won. You know, they weren't that good of horses. But then I said, I'm not coming back to that guy. I just can't, you know, I'm not, they're not good enough, and I'm going to get beat up and take this guy. He was just, this guy was tough. He's the kind of guy that, and the guy before him, one trainer left his tack room light on, and the guy would drive through there, and he called the guy up. He says, did you leave your tack room light on? He says, oh, it was a mistake. And for a week, the guy had to unscrew the bulb and bring it to his office and come get it in the morning. I mean, that's
unbelievable.
That's what they used to do.
That's tremendous.
You know, you can't get away with that now, but.
Wow.
So then finally he was gone, and Brad calls me up. Hey, that guy's gone. You know, that guy's gone. We got a new guy. He's a good guy. He'll help you out. He'll give you whatever you need. And I had better horses, but I'll tell you what, Steve, I had, like, it was in the winter meet. I had 40 horses. So I picked my best 8 horses, and I took them out there for the winter meet just for a couple months, just to try it out. If it worked, then I'd stay. If it not, and I'll never forget the first night I had my 3 best horses in. The first one runs 4th. The second one ran 4th. And my best filly, she's in the feature, 5 o'clock rush. She's in the one hole. And I told Brad, I said, Brad, and he's like, don't worry. Just, you know, Brad was my cheerleader. Said, don't worry. Come on. He said, if this filly doesn't win, I'm out of here. I can't make it. I'm gone. I'm going to just pack my stuff. And I'll just rather be the big fish in the little pond, you know. And damn if that filly didn't win. She wins the race by a head. And that was it. That's all I needed. I needed that, you know, that little push. And then I went back to California. And I just told everybody, you know what, I'm sorry, but you guys going to need other a trainer for your other horses here. I'm getting out. But what happened, see, Relito had closed. So we didn't have a lot of racing. So during the winter for a couple of years, I had to train at Turf Paradise outside. I had to rent a barn and then walk my horses like about almost like a half a mile to the track to get them ready for Prescott for the fair. So that wasn't going to work out. So I went to Los Alamitos and I just picked up, and Brad McKenzie really helped me. He introduced me to a lot of people and started picking up horses from other people I didn't know. And I mean, he was really so instrumental in that. And not only that, he was just a good friend anyway, but just so instrumental. And he was my biggest cheerleader.
The filly's name again, 5 o'clock?
5 o'clock rush.
5 o'clock rush. That's
and
a good name.
You know
name.
What? When I tried the Thoroughbreds, the last horse we had like a Breeders' Cup type race at Los Alamitos already. And I just won
Champion of Champions, or
no? It's like they had this Breeders' Cup. They tried the Breeders' Cup, their own little Breeders' Cup, and so it was Cal Cup. I'd won 4 stakes on Cal Cup race day, and I went down and I had a bunch in that night. And the last race of the night was this little 2-year-old stake race, and it was 8 o'clock rush was in there. It was 5 o'clock rush's baby. And he won, and I quit that night.
And that was the end of the...
That was the end of
so
it.
So you started with 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock rush got you going, and ended with 8 o'clock.
And that was my last one.
That's tremendous.
So I think really everything happened for a reason. And so I was done and walked away. I just left all my tack there, bought all new tack, and gave it to my friends. I had Laura Pinelli, who was my assistant. She got most of them. Carlos Lopez, he's a trainer down there. I gave him the horses, and Jaime Gomez was just a bloodstock agent there, and he took a lot of my equipment. He started out, so and that's, you know,
who was the first owner to express confidence and give you Thoroughbred?
Well, Hal Earnhardt, I was training quarter horse for him, and you know, he's been my longest
sure.
supporter. I've had him since 1983. And he bought a Thoroughbred, and then Mike Pegram, they were friends through his father Tex, and they bought a quarter horse together. And that's how I met Mike.
Okay.
For a year, and then Mike says, "What?" And he said, "You know what? Why don't you try Thoroughbreds?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. That's, you know, I'd have to learn." And so I said, "Well, if you give me a year, let me claim a few, and then we'll do it." And
play
he said,
around.
Sure, go ahead. You know, let me get because I still had my quarter horses. So it took me a couple of years just to get my footing, and it was all trial and error. And but they were really patient, and when our, you know, Mike was a lot of fun. I remember he took me to my first Super Bowl. I was 49ers down in Miami. I played Cincinnati.
I was going to say the Bengals. That was a good game.
The catch. I was there.
That was a good game.
I was there in the sitting in the end zone there, and so it just, you know, really took me to places I've never been, you know, with Mike, you know, like I've never flown first class or done anything like that. I mean, it was, you know, with Mike, it was just first class. So we hit it off, and I asked him one time, we're getting in the elevator. He said, "No, Mike, why did you pick me? You know, why would you?" He said, "Let me tell you something. In this business, you lose more than you win, and you're a lot more fun to be with when we lose." I'll never forget when he said that, you know. So well
and that's you know, that's an insight that should be that should be etched somewhere, because Tommy Kelly said, when you hire as an owner, when you hire a trainer, when you pick a trainer, you're buying a friend. And so make sure it's somebody that you want to, that you're going to, you have a rapport with, and that you have an energy with and you have fun with. Because you, as Pegram says, you lose more than you win.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been that way. I mean, I've had really, you know, now I've got, I have really good chemistry with certain people. Some guys, I just knew from the beginning, you know, it's probably not, this is not going to jive. It's not my, and a lot of people can be intimidated by me, and they shouldn't, because I'm really sort of a laid-back kind of guy, you know. And so then when they get to know me, they go, you know what, you're not at all like people say you are and all that. And so I really don't, you know, once people get to know me, I'm like, you know, I used to like to joke around. A lot of people didn't like my humor. But the reason I do that is just you'll go crazy if you don't. You know, this game, if you let it, will make you bitter. So you have to keep digging your way out of it. So there's going to be, I know I keep telling my wife that.
Well,
you know,
put. Well,
it's,
put.
She'll get really down on everything. I said, you know, honey, it's still the greatest sport. It's fun. I've met the best. I've made a lot of friends. You meet really interesting people. You know, I've met presidents. I've met, you know, all these kings and sheiks and all these people and a few movie stars. And, you know, it's sort of like...
Yeah, it's glamorous.
It's a very glamorous... And the quarter horse, you don't have that. See, the quarter horse, you just don't have...
Got a lot of belt buckles, a lot of hats.
A lot of belt buckles and hats, and I'll tell you what, he's ready, Bob. So it's one of those things where... And I look back, and I remember I wanted to win the All-American Futurity. And I went back, and I had a horse in it, but I couldn't... I was just getting the thoroughbred business, and his name was Ed Grimley. So I sent it to a trainer, and they said, we're going to just split it. And his name is Sleepy Galbraith, you know. And so really nice guy, just laid back.
That's why they called him Sleepy.
He looks like Sleepy from the Seven Doors. He's got that face on him, you know. Nice guy. And so we went over there, and Mike Pegram, we got a little jet. We flew over there. It was about eight of us. My brother Bill went. We had a blast, you know. And so... And Mike Pegram, he's in the paddock. He says, man, he says, I've never seen a paddock where whoever wins this race is going to change their life because they're going to get $1 million. It's just, you know,
yeah.
I'll never forget. He said that. He says, yeah, because the guy that I trained for, he said, man, if I win this race, I'm going to buy myself a dairy down in Roswell, New Mexico. He had a dairy in Phoenix. And I'm doing, you know, all these plans. And we got beat ahead. We got caught right at the wire. But you know what? I didn't feel that excitement because I'd already been in the thoroughbred, and I was training Indian Charlie's mother at the time. I'd won a little steak with her. So I got a flavor of
what
the big
be.
Time.
What could happen. Yeah.
You know, and so like, wow, this is, you know, it's like, and after that, I said, I can't believe I used to give the quarter horse jockeys instructions. I mean, just hold on, dude. You
know. Don't fall off.
Yeah.
What? You go back to the transition and to starting to get your hands on thoroughbreds, and what did you find that you ended up needing to learn, and what surprised you about thoroughbreds that you didn't expect?
Well, I mean, they're, you know, they have to train basically every day. Where a quarter horse, once you get them fit, you don't have to do too much.
It's easy to keep them fit.
You walk them, you gallop them maybe every other day, a little easy, keep them sharp, keep them sound. Got to keep them really sound. Quarter horses, you have to keep them very, very sound, because if they're not, if something's bugging them, they won't break. And if they don't break,
it's over.
It's over. It's over. So you have to really keep them really healthy and very sound. Where a thoroughbred, you know, you have to track them every day. But then there's you have to handicap. You have to handicap your horse. Distances, you know, that was the hardest part. Is he a sprinter? Does he want to go long? Does he want to do this and that? And so... You know, it took me, and I'm still learning. I'm still learning to this day. And but one of these days, I'm going to figure it out completely. But I'm not there yet. But
seems like you're pretty close.
It's one of those things where it was just trial and error. I never worked for anybody.
Yeah.
If I could have gone to work for somebody, it would have jump started my. So I just started on my own, and I was just listening to people.
But it may have also the flip side of that is, you basically. were a blank slate, as opposed to having somebody whose angle on horses colors your approach and stamps your approach. You basically were a blank slate and you just started to add the information. How long did it take you to begin to understand the physical differences, you know, in terms of stride, length of body, the way a thoroughbred grows and changes as they age?
Well, I mean, to me, I think what I brought into is I had a lot of good luck buying my own quarter horses. And so I went to the sales. I remember going to the Keeneland sale the first time. I was like, wow. Man, I saw the beautiful ones, and I see a pretty one, you know, and I follow them up there. And I had a budget, $20,000.
For how many?
For one.
Okay, for one.
For
all
one.
Right.
I'd go up there. That thing would bring $300,000-$400,000. This is crazy. These people are crazy. What are they thinking about, you know? So then I go back. You know, for $20,000, I get a great quarter horse. So, this went on for 3 days. Just, I was getting up.
So, book one, book two?
Book two. Finally, I think we got to about book three, and I see this big, gray, long-bodied, beautiful, stout horse. And I remember this. There was a guy that used to be in the quarter horse. He was managing the farm there, and he looks at me and says, "Hey, Baffert, those aren't the type you want." I said, "Dude, I'm sticking with what I like."
Yeah.
And before that, I went to Claiborne Farms, and I wanted to look at all the stallions to see, get an idea. I saw Secretariat. I wanted to see him, and he was this big shoulder, his neck, big deep heart girded, but he didn't have much of a hind end. He was really post legged.
Yeah.
And I really wasn't like, wow, you know, it's not really
not
my
what you
type.
Expected.
No. And then I saw Spectacular Bid. He's a, you know, not great, nice looking, but light, really light bone. You know, beautiful conformation, long neck, but light bone. Like, and then I liked Nijinsky the second. I didn't like him at all. He was too thoroughbred for me, you know. That's what I used to say, you know, too light. And then I saw Mr. Prospector look pretty good, but he was a little bit, you know, upright. His shoulder was a little straight or something. I remember he was all right. But the horse they brought out that I love was Danzig.
Hmm.
When they brought him out, I go, "That's me right there." So that's what I stuck to. So all of a sudden, I see this gray horse, and I said, "Man, he's beautiful." I follow him up there, and I have this guy with me, this quarter horse owner, and we're sitting there, and we start bidding, and we get up to 20, and then somebody hits him at 21. I said, "Come on, dude, you got to hit him." "No, no, no, 20. That's all I'll go." I said, "Come on, hit him at 21. He said, you know, hit 22. And he says, "You know what?" I said, "If you love him so much, you have a lot of big other owners. Why don't you buy him for them?" So when he said that, he sort of got me like mad. You know?
Yeah.
So I hit him. All right. So I hit him again, 25, 26, probably 29. So I was like, I hit him at 30. And when I hit him at 30, Steve, I said, "Please, somebody hit him. Please."
You didn't want it at that point.
I'm going over. I don't know. Who am I going to sell this horse to? I'm nervous. I'm scared. Finally, 30, sold right there. And I go, "Oh, man." They brought the pad over. You got to fill it out. I fill that thing out, put my address, you know, name of the firstborn, everything. I filled out the whole thing. And I'm shaking. I'm shaking. I write my name. I get up right away. I got to go get a better look at this horse. I'm walking out. I'm going by there, and I see that same guy's back there. He says, "Baffert, don't tell me you bought that horse." I said, "Yep, I got him." He said, so I go down there, and I'm looking at him, and there was a guy a quarter horse trainer from Texas that was there waiting at the barn. And I'm running to him. I said, "Hey, what are you doing here?" "Ah, oh, I'm waiting to see they bought this horse back, and I'm going to, you know, see, I'm going to offer him something." So I go out there and say, "Hey, can I see a gray horse out here, please, that just sold?" He said, "Oh, you're looking at him too?" I says, "I just bought him." He says, "Wow." He said, "It was Ben Walden that I bought him from." And he goes, he told me he was going to bring $60,000, so I didn't bid on him. Well, I bought him for $30,000, and I tell you what, I don't have a buyer for him, but if you give me $1,000, I'll give you the ticket, I told him. And he says, "Nah, it's okay." So then I've got it now. Then all of a sudden I start getting paged. "Bob Baffert, please come to the main office." So I go up there and I go, "Excuse me, I just got paged like sir, you just bought a purchase of a horse and you don't have credit here. Well, I'm here. My name is Bob Baffert. I'm a big quarter horse trainer. You know, I started giving you all this deal. He says, we don't care. We need a call. Luckily, I took a check with me. I always had it carried a check with me. I'll write you a check right now. He says, well, sir, we have to call your bank, make sure this check is. I barely had enough money to cover that check.
That's unbelievable.
I had like $32,000.
That's great.
And they put a stop on that. They grabbed that money right there. So I said, oh, this is nice. And then I call Hal Earnhardt, and I made a mistake. He didn't answer, and I talked to his wife. I said, I bought this horse for $30,000. I should have just waited. So by the time I called him back, that's with the payphone. You know, I had to get on the payphone. And so then I called back. He says, you know, he tells me later, finally, I call him back. He says, you know what? It's just too much. I can't do it and all this stuff. Because, you know, if I would have just talked to him myself, I could have.
Yeah, she already. The fix was it.
The fix was in. I made a big mistake. You know? And so I'm coming back, and Artie Hubbard, he'd given me a ride in his plane from Los Alamitos. And he was going back, so I says, when I go back, I'll go back with you. I was on a super, this is a profit deal for me. I was on a super low budget. So he says, and he goes, hey, Babbert, did you buy anything? I said, matter of fact, I didn't. I don't have an owner. I said, you want to take half? I'll keep half of it. I already paid for him. I said, I had to pay for him right away, but I took all my savings out of that thing. And so, and he looks at the pedigree and he brings
what
out
was the pedigree?
He was by Sloopy out of a Hatchetman mare. And so, but you know what's funny? I told Jimmy Bell after I bought him, I went to John Bell Farm. I hadn't seen Jimmy Bell in 15 years.
Since
the U of A.
Yeah.
So I said, did you buy anything? Yes. Matter of fact, I did. And I opened up my wallet and I had the page folded up in my wallet. I bought this horse right here. He says, wow. He's just Sloopy. He says, we stand Sloopy. He's right here. Really? I said, and he wasn't doing that well, you know.
Uh-huh.
No kidding. I go, wow. And what kind of Mary says, damn, I didn't even notice the pedigree. I didn't even look. The pedigree didn't mean nothing.
It was the body, the physical.
Said, it's a Hatchetman. When we were going to school, we got CB radios. Remember when the CB radios were out?
Sure.
Well, I went to his house, and he had a blood horse on his table. And there was a horse called Hatchetman was on the cover. I said, you know what? That's going to be my CB handle, Hatchetman.
Oh.
And to this day, Jimmy Bill still he
calls
still
you Hatchet, man?
Hatchet. Hey Hatchet, what's going on?
That's never called great.
So I go, he's out of a Hatchet Man mirror. I just and Sloopy's here. This horse has to be a runner. I'm telling you, I believe in that stuff. And sure enough, it was 30 slews. Wins a Breeders' Cup sprint.
Unbelievable.
Got him home. I sent him right to Los Alamitos. I van him to Los Alamitos. And I cut him up with my quarter horse owners, and I kept a piece. And Mike Pegram took a piece, and we win the Breeders' Cup Sprint with him.
That's unbelievable!
Unbelievable! So what? And I gelded him immediately, you know. So what a horse! So, but I you know what? He taught me a lot. I mean, he was a really good horse, and I wasn't really ready for a horse like that. And I almost ruined him. I was trying to put him on the Derby trail there and all that stuff, and. But he was a really good sprinter, big beautiful horse.
And you know, you say that you weren't ready, quote unquote. And there is from him there is a little bit of a lag before you know you start to really send out a sequence of of top horses, classic horses, and every other kind of stake horse. Bob
yeah,
Lewis.
But I was still like in the year before that I went to the Breeders' Cup. I took. Soviet Sojourn. It was Indian Charlie's.
Oh yeah,
Churchill, and she was tailing off on me, and I didn't know what I was. You know what? I look back, and I'll never forget. I went to the Churchill Downs. It must have been like it was so cold. It was like 40 degrees or whatever.
Yeah, it was a terrible, terrible day.
It was cold. I'm walking up there, and I have a Oxford shirt on. And it's so cold, and I had a sport coat, no overcoat, nothing. I didn't, I wasn't. And I'm walking up there, and I'm freezing. I'm walking up. It was, just me and my groom, and I'm walking up there, and and I'll never forget, my nipples were so hard, and they were rubbing against his super hard start shirt, and I'm telling you, that's all I could think about, and I kept grabbing myself they were just raw by the time I got up there, and I got my ass kicked, and it was just terrible. But you know what? I saw Arazi.
Azari or Arazi?
Arazi. His race was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was.
I'll never forget that. That was one of the most
unforgettable
classic performances I've ever seen. And I learned a lot from that. And I remember I was at Stain there, and I was across, and I saw Woody Stevens was at a little. I saw him across at this table having dinner, and he was getting. He was pretty old then. He had an oxygen tank. He had it on his. And I wanted to walk up and introduce myself to him, but I was too scared. I was too intimidated to go up there and introduce myself. Like, hey, I'm a new trainer. I'm trying to get into business. But I wish I would have gone up there and talked to him, because he was just, I really enjoyed watching. He was, he brought a lot to the sport. I loved listening to all his little one-liners, and stuff. But, I was sort of shy and intimidated to walk up to him and say, hey, I just want to meet you, and didn't do it.
Well, from there, though, the tables have turned, as you suggest. Some people, they see you and they're intimidated, and they shouldn't be either.
Yeah, and so when people, I've had young trainers come up, hey, I'm starting out. And I remember that. I said, well, good luck to you. Any words of wisdom? I said, yeah, you better be ready to work 7 days a week and just live it and breathe it. That's all. If you want to be successful, you got to live it and breathe it, because not only you're responsible for all those horses, but you're responsible for a lot of employees, families that count on you. That's a lot of pressure. Like this winter, when we were having problems out there at Santa Anita, that was one of the big things that, if this doesn't work out, I got a lot of families that are counting on me, and they just can't pick up and all go or whatever, and they've been with me for 20 years and seen all their kids grow up. So there's a lot of extra pressure that that people don't know about, but it's been very, I'm so lucky that it worked out. And I'm glad that my grandmother lent me that $1,000. I don't know what would have happened if she didn't give me the money, but it was, things happen for a reason.
It's one of the, it's one of the things about the game that, there's a certain degree of luck that, that just is out there to be captured. And I suppose some of it, some of it is just knowing, just being relaxed and as you, as you've discussed before, adjusting. How you always talk about making decisions with horses during the run up on the classic trail and just making those decisions on feel.
Well, I remember when I was like 16, Wayne Lucas comes into Sonoyta with these shiny trailers and these fancy horses to run in the trials, and I went up to the fence and go, and everybody was saying, that's Wayne Lucas, man, that's that guy that's like, and I wanted to go up and introduce myself. I was scared to death of Wayne. I was like, that's him, and I got a close look, and I'm watching him, and man, not only is he's a great horseman and horse trainer, he's a great horseman. But he was a good showman, and he knew how to, for the better, he knew how to promote the sport. He really, and when he came into the quarter horse business, he changed Los Alamitos quarter horse. The barns, all of a sudden, he had the most beautiful barns.
The flowers.
We'd go in there and he'd rake at the herringbone. Every time I see a herringbone rake job, that's Wayne Lucas. And people that tried to go toe-to-toe with him, they went broke. They couldn't stay up because he kept winning. And then when he came to the thoroughbreds, he changed it all. And during the process, he sort of rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And they, you know, and so, you know, the thing about Wayne, he was never really, when you come from the quarter horse and just jumped in there, he was really totally never accepted fully when you come for the hard boots, and because he didn't come up from, you know, they think a lot of the trainers are, you know, come in like, you know, the typical trainer's supposed to look like Leroy Jolly.
There you go.
You know, the old, I love Leroy. I got to know him his last few years. I just love, and you know what? I told Leroy when I saw him, I said, when I see you, Leroy, I'm intimidated. Because to me, Leroy was above me. Because I watched him, you know, I think he was a great trainer and all these guys. And I see him, just like Lasbro and those guys.
Yeah.
I would never consider myself at their level. To me, they're still above me. You know what I mean? So when you see these guys when you're growing up on television.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and Laz, I used to pick their brain, these older guys.
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
Whittingham.
I tell you what's helped me, and I tell my kids, is you got to be very curious in life.
Absolutely.
And you have to ask questions. Are we running a little long here?
They're calling for you.
They're calling for me?
Yeah.
All right, Steve.
But I got you warmed up.
I saw Todd Pletcher showed up. They told me he wouldn't show up.
Why not?
Showed up. Actually, Todd actually graduated in 4 years. It took me six. So, all right.
Enjoy it.
Thank you.
This was fabulous. Thank you.
All right.
As always, unbelievable. Bob Baffert, let's take a break. I'm digging into, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to dig into everybody's time with the kids. And let's take a break. Hammer's coming right back, and we're going to get some kids on, and we're going to get Sid Fernando in for a visit, and he's going to explain about the, you know, how to get into the pedigree side. If you're a young person and you want to work for a farm, you want to work on the sales end, you want to work for a consigner, Sid will talk about that and how, you know, we know how the horse side works and probably a lot of the business side, you know, track operators and so forth. But that's an area. And when we were here last year, you know, there was, I think in all the time we've been coming, there's only been one of the students that had expressed a bloodstock interest. Now I've been introduced to two or three more, and so we'll get Sid in for that too. A lot of fun. How about that story? And delivered perfectly from Baffert about 30 slews, because everybody was saying, "Did the horse become anything? Who's the horse?" And 30 slews. That was great.